Welcome to Whistleblowers, episode 13. My name is Greg Kerr, and that's the sound of a Cessna aeroplane that's taken off successfully. Today's episode starts with what happens when your Cessna doesn't take off successfully. Well, Americans woke to Fox News this week to that story, and Australians weren't surprised.
And burnt, the wreckage of a Cessna 420C at the centre of a failed international drug run. It
would have been one of the highest drug busts in relation to cocaine that we've experienced.
Abandoned and emptied, its narcotic cargo dumped in rainforest in Papua New Guinea. After 6 days of searching, police uncovered 28 bags containing $80 million worth of cocaine.
This flight and its contents represents the worst of organised crime and the greed of syndicates trying to line their pockets at the expense and health of the Australian community.
This is the plane taking off from Mareeba Airport in far north Queensland on Sunday. Flying illegally at under 3,000 feet to avoid radar detection, landing just south of Port Moresby, 500 kilograms of cocaine is smuggled into the aircraft. Hours later, the overloaded Cessna tries to take off from a remote landing strip in Papua Lay Lay, bound for Queensland, crashing seconds after takeoff.
The AFP cannot discount that greed led to the aircraft crashing, given the weight of the cocaine is likely to have impacted on the plane's ability to take off.
Upon landing, police say the drugs were to be driven from Mareeba to Victoria in the back of this truck, hidden in a load of gyprock. The foiled plot, the work of an Italian crime syndicate based in Victoria. The masterminds arrested in Melbourne.
Believed to be the kingpins behind this operation, 'Ndrangheta Mafia members Salvatore Formica and Pierino Forni will face an extradition hearing on the 10th of August to be brought here to Queensland, where they will go before court with their co-accused.
Behind bars in Cairns, 31-year-old Aidan Coder, Sydney man George Merheb, and the truck driver Osman Al-Huli. Their arrest, the end of a two-year joint agency operation. All five men are now facing life behind bars.
Well, good morning, folks, and it's over now to Jennifer Stone. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, Glenn.
And, wow, I can't believe the coincidence. Last episode, those that were listening, Jennifer was talking about the drug networks and the organised crime, and she had one story of a gentleman who used to regularly fly heroin in from Asia. And I couldn't believe the coincidence this week when this story broke. And what happens when your Cessna won't take off and you're in Papua New Guinea? You may have too much cocaine on board. So these poor souls now spend the rest of their life in jail. And it was a little Cessna model light aircraft. It was flying illegally below the radar. And Australians are aware of this type of thing, maybe in small numbers. The wider population maybe not so aware of it. You're certainly aware of it, Jennifer, because you've been researching and you're an investigative journalist and a novelist, and you've written about this type of crime network for years. And, you know, I guess once it goes off the news, many of us forget about it. But you've got more information to tell us today about this type of transportation of illegal substances.
Yes, yes. Thanks for that. Yes, this cocaine bust, you think about it, a pilot and he's flying low. He doesn't log his documents no. for where he's flying. No. He doesn't want anyone to know where he's going.
That's right.
So he wouldn't even probably have a passport. And that's what he did. When he crashed, 2 days later he went into the Australian Embassy and handed himself in.
That's right.
Because how could he get out of Papua New Guinea? You know, he was stuck. And that was what brought down this whole network. Though within the investigation, you know, some of the police are feeding us crap, I think, because they're saying they've been investigating this for 2 years. Well, why wouldn't they have done a bust on the first load or second load?
Yeah.
Because they're doing 4 tonnes of cocaine just in Sydney, you know, through the sewer systems getting tested in a year. So what about Melbourne? You know, this drug network was going to drive it, as they said, down in Melbourne in Gyprock. But I've heard about the Gyprock before, and I got told about the Gyprock back in 2011, that cocaine gets hidden in Gyprock. And you think, why would it be? But if you think about it, the inside of Gyprock is white. And the paper on the outside, and if you know what you're doing, you probably can drill a hole and put enough in it or just pack it in between.
For our overseas listeners, the Gyprock here in Australia is the name given to the plastering product that's used in house building and construction and renovations, and it's that white substance, chalk type substance that they use to finish off the insides of walls and things. So quite amazing. Last week you spoke about organised crime, bigger levels, and the police, the authorities. It is quite amazing that they've all come out of the woodwork, the police, and they're pounced on this one and said it's been a 2 year investigation. If the plane hadn't have crashed, one can't help but think what would have happened.
That's right. They're not following up enough. They may be watching it. Well, yeah, I want my cut too, maybe. But it's interesting that I had linked the Gyprock into, and people talked about double layering. So you start to think, and it happened at Arncliffe is where I noticed this, or Tempe area. New high-rise units would go, and I'd say to the coppers, I think there's drugs coming out of here. And there'd be not many units, like, with people in. So you think, well, can't they work this out? But then you start to think, the drug dealers would turn up when the units were new, and then after a couple of months, they'd be gone, right? And it was quite a system. But if the cocaine is in the Gyprock when it gets put up into certain units, they only got to strip it off. And no one had noticed it with double layer of Gyprock, even if it's cement render. Some cement render units can have a layer of Gyprock on top.
Wonderful. That's amazing. You know, I hadn't thought of that. The average person probably doesn't think about that, but it's happening all around us, and police keep convincing themselves that they're winning the war on drugs. But Jennifer, you've got more information about this, you know, flying of aircraft, and I know in America we've seen lots of TV series and movies based on the transportation of cocaine from the American, South American cartels up into mainland America. And you've got information there from the past, and you've written about it in your book, Q plus 17. What did you want to say about this information?
Well, it's interesting because this Cessna went down and it was a remote area of far north Queensland. I've got a unsolved murder, and I link into this, and I've even talked to the wife. So, and it's quite an interesting one. So it's on Bruce Schuller, S-C-H-U-L-E-R. So two people have been found guilty of the murder, but the body went missing. And I talked to the wife about it. So it happened on New Year's Eve, 2012. Bruce Schuller was a gold prospector, a retired father of two, and he was just spending some time looking for gold with his metal detectors. And he had some friends, so he wasn't really that old. He was only 48, and they drove on to a Palmerville station. And it was actually the Mr. and Mrs. that was on Palmerville station that actually got charged with the murder and have been found guilty.
Yeah.
And they're in two different prisons. And people have said that the wife, that the female that got charged, would talk, but really she hasn't talked enough because they have not been able to find Bruce Shuler's body. So he was there prospecting and he had some four friends and they were quite close and they heard at 10 o'clock a car coming up the track to where Bruce was, and then they actually heard one gunshot and then they heard another gunshot 15 minutes later. At 11 a.m. the three men returned to the campsite where they found Mr. Shuler's dog at the vehicle, but no sign of the missing friend. So they hung around to 4:30 in the afternoon. Now that part of it, if I thought my friend had been shot dead and just disappeared, I would have run off.
Exactly.
I wouldn't have stayed. But they actually stayed. Now, they stayed at the farm, which is 5.5 hours longer in this danger zone, to see what would happen to Shuler's car, to see if he came back to it. Mr. Anderson, one of his friends that were with him, called Palmerville Station Homestead at 6:16 p.m. and 6:19 p.m. and left a voicemail advising that he heard shots and would call the police if he did not hear from Mr. Shuler within half an hour. Now, this was in the coroner's summary of events. So the coroner has investigated this too. And the family pushed for this because they wanted a police search warrant to go in there and search this farm. Now, the farm's huge.
Yeah.
Absolute. It's the size of Hong Kong.
Wow.
So that is huge.
One farm.
One farm. 134,000 hectares, and it's Queensland, Cape York Peninsula.
Right.
So talking to the wife of Bruce, I found out that I said, you know, the only way they could get him out of there would be a plane. And there was an airstrip a couple of farms away. And we talked about, you know, was it a mail plane or was it another sort of plane?
Like a seaplane or something like
that.
Yeah,
no, not a seaplane.
No.
Could be a mail plane.
Yeah.
But, you know, there were other planes, little planes that
small
would land
planes.
There.
Yeah, yep.
So Mr. Shuler pleaded not guilty to the charges, while Mrs. Wilson Struber did not enter a plea. She didn't enter a plea.
Wow.
So the case led to the station owners being jailed for the Marby man's murder, so Bruce Struber. So it's interesting that his body has not been found. They found blood and they matched it to Bruce's DNA, so they know he was there on it. And people related it. There was evidence given linking Wilson Struber, claimed the disappearance related to a feud over drugs and with other minors. But, you know, there's still a body missing. So the family tried to get this police search warrant. They've also tried, the farm's been sold, and they tried to get the new owners to allow them on. Now, it's interesting that the wife, this Wilson Struber, that got charged with the murder, her brother is still working on the farm. And they haven't been allowed in to look. Now I talked to them about, you know, sheds on the property and if they had equipment on the property to dig enough. So in the cannabis industry or in the drug making, they'll sink containers into the ground and put a shed on top of it with an access port into the containers so that they can go and check and it's quite safe. If cops turn up, it's normally a mate that they know, and that seems to be one way. And since I've found out about that and told the police about this system, they have caught some.
Have they?
And that was in the Central Coast area in New South Wales.
Right.
And it was definitely the containers would be put into the ground and then covered up. And then later on, they'd go back and build the shed. Right. So it was a time process too. And most of them would forget about the big hole in the containers.
Right.
So this has a 70 kilometres of double frontage onto the Palmer River and a rolling lease to 2035.
Okay.
So it's just interesting. There's 30... So the area in Queensland's the largest alluvial gold deposits and has more than 30 mining leases in the area. Now, this was 2012. The property was sold on the 20th of August 2019. So it took 7 years for the property to sell. And 2 days after the death, as the coroner reported, the sun went down with 30 police and SES officers walking side by side in the emu parade through the scrub for hours, scanning the ground for something, but they found nothing.
Wow.
And that's an interesting...
So how did you get interested in this story? What made you have a little bit closer at it?
Well, it fitted the pattern. The body went missing. Though there's not many where they found the person who murdered the person. So Michael Guida fits that pattern for Samantha Knight. But there's not many where the body goes missing. And that was of interest to me. And how come the coroner wouldn't sign for the police search warrant? I really believe that the coroner believed there was no body on this land at all.
Right.
And... So the only evidence was specks of blood on rocks and a burnt-out patch of grass. So they've done this burning to get rid of the DNA evidence, but it's still left enough, you know. And, like, what happens if they picked him up and put him in the back of the ute and then drove him off? You know, they went down back to the farmhouse. They'd only have to keep driving out and go somewhere and... You know, these guys wouldn't have known what happened to their friend.
So Jennifer's written extensively on various topics, and this is one of them. And it's worth mentioning that those interested in e-books and online information, Jennifer's book Q+17 was released on the 16th of June of this year on the Amazon.com. E-book site, so you can refer to Q+17 Jennifer Stone for more information on this story. And Jennifer, you've alluded there to missing persons. Do you think they'll ever find this body?
Well, I don't know whether we'll find the body, but we will find something. And I'll tell you why. When I first started on this assignment, I started 2009 doing some research, and I've had some research come up with me with my own background. But in 2011 to 12, I actually spent a few nights out at the Eastern Suburbs Cemetery of a night on the other side of the road, watching the people turn in on a full moon down to the cremator. And I started to think, it was one car after another, and it was about midnight, nearly to midnight, and I started to think this was a bit weird. And after the cars kind of stopped, it would have been like 20-odd cars, I thought, am I brave enough to drive down there to see what's happening? And I thought, well, it's just a road. So I drove down, and that's how I could see there was this shed and... There was so many cars there and the chimney for the cremator. And I'm thinking, what if they're getting rid of bodies? This is like perfect scenario.
Yeah.
Then there's no evidence.
Yes.
And I started to, and I put it into the cops about it, but I thought I didn't have enough research, but you start to think, and then there were gates put up. So it changed. I actually went for a job
at the cemetery.
At the cemetery to see what was happening.
Wow.
you know, and I got taken all through the office because it all relates to office work and what's happening.
Mm.
Like if they're getting paid, if there's, you know, who's got the keys for that area. That's all the links that the police need to know.
Yeah.
You know.
And if you want to get rid of a body, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah. So would there be evidence? Well, how this works is normally the gangs, this is how I allege, they'll collect the evidence to a police level and it links to ex-police involved, and that's what I got told by Sammy Swee. So you start to think that, you know, this murder happened in 2012 on New Year's Eve. So the 15th of May 2013, there was a report about an undercover police officer who brought down a key Bandidos member after a nine-month sting that involved him buying drugs. Now, this was on the Bandidos Cairns chapter. So I started to think, wow, that was in Cairns, not far. And this lady even said Cairns is not far, but full of Bandidos. And it's interesting, I had linked to Bandidos in King's Cross.
Mm.
So if it all related, they'd have to have some evidence on them if the drugs are coming through. That keeps them honest in the underworld. But it relates to murder. It relates to something that they've done.
Exactly.
You know, some will be premeditated to a pattern. This wasn't. They were protecting their own property. But why shoot the guy?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like you could scare a guy, ask him to leave, but why shoot? What was there? What was going to be exposed if the cops came?
Mm.
Well, they knew they were going to have cops, but they also knew not to give any evidence. So the brother was never really interviewed by what I've heard. And though the two got found guilty of murder, one didn't plead guilty or not guilty. She's the person that they believe had the long rifle in her arm, so she'd have to be a crack shot to do it with one bullet. But 15 minutes later, another bullet? Sounds like it could have been a bit of a standover something. But then to have it go missing. Well, about 6 o'clock that night, I believe, there was supposed to be a plane takeoff. So it's interesting that it connects. But the police couldn't find the flight plans. And you know, and they're the things that they should be watching for. But they did catch a lot of Bandidos at that time. 15 Bandido murders and bikie associates were charged with a total of 51 drug trafficking and weapon offences after the raids of 20 properties. But still, they didn't find Bruce Shuler's body.
Wow.
You know, and I'll just say this, his family have tried very hard and they've put up these big roadside signs, been approved by the Queensland government and the state, to say, if you've seen this guy, you know, they're not, they're looking as though he could be still alive.
Yeah.
But really,
we think he was in the wrong place. They said the wrong time.
Yes.
Well, it finishes up a very interesting episode. And, you know, that covers that story on the plane that wouldn't take off. And now we've got bikie gangs. And it leads us into Missing Persons Week.
National Missing Persons Week, which starts officially today.
Our hearts go out to the families who've lost a loved one like Bruce, with no answers, and the lonely nights, the unsolved murders we cover here on Whistleblowers.
Police are hoping heightened awareness and insight insight into the unresolved grief of loved ones may lead to some answers. And for more on this, we're joined now by Jodie McEwen, who is from the National Missing Persons Coordination Centre, along with Gary and Marlene English, who are desperately still looking for their son, Peter. Thank you all so much for being with us. We'll start with...
Well, it goes on, folks. So, Jennifer, do you want to finish up with anything on this topic or what we've spoken about today?
Yes, I'll talk about a 1973 disappearance, which is the person of the week, Michael Croker. Now, he was just aged 18 and he was last seen at Prince Henry Hospital in Little Bay. It's very close to that Eastern Suburb Cemetery that I talked about. So where he was staying as a patient on the Friday, the 20th of October, 1973. You know, Halloween's like less than 10 days away.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a bit of a build-up too, so you start to think. But it's interesting that this guy, they thought was seen in King's Cross.
Right.
Now, within a lot of the reports, they'll say, oh, seen in King's Cross, like years later. But really, it's lead. But the police haven't learnt that. Someone's rung up and said, you know, look in King's Cross. But they think, well, this person just vanished. He actually was taken to the hospital and left his bag on a bed and never unpacked it, which is interesting to go to the hospital. He had... There was a problem.
Yeah, and
he disappeared. But he had his bag and didn't unpack it. Now it's very easy when you're at hospital. Remember, this guy was really 18, so it's just a kid and a country bumpkin to begin with. So he'd have no idea about Sydney, and he. You think about it. You come up to you, someone dressed like a doctor, and says, "Follow me." What would happen? They would follow.
Yep.
And you know, and that's how someone can just, you know, within some of the systems, I say they walk to their own death.
Yes, there's certain people that we just trust unconditionally, like someone in a doctor's coat or whatever.
Or a police officer.
Or a police officer.
Yes, or someone that says, which I had back. In some time, a man who said to my daughter, I'm a police officer, and she believed him.
Yeah.
And today, an arrest warrant was put out for him.
Righto.
So it's the same guy. He was talking to me one way, and when my daughter said, who's on the phone, she grabbed it, and he said, I'm a police officer.
It's the same as the Falconer bodies, the body in the bags, famous story here, where the, you know... criminal who was, you know, imprisoned was on parole, and
Peter Falconer,
and two plainclothes detectives came and said they just wanted to have a chat with Pete, and he was just doing his release time at a panel beaters, and he trusted them.
Yeah.
And little did he know that they were just two blokes in suits, and that was the last we saw of Pete. But interesting stuff, Jennifer. We might end it there.
Thank you for the chat today.
It's been very interesting. You know, I'm learning more, and we might come back next episode with some information you've got on King's Cross, some developments with the pedophile rings, and many other topics that we'll be covering in the weeks to come. So stay tuned to Whistleblowers. My name is Greg Kerr, and this has been Jennifer Stone, Australia's leading novelist, investigative journalist and crime investigator, on the job 24/7 in cafes, outside cemeteries and around the corner, keeping an eye out for people living life on the fringes and living and cutting things fine. Greg Kerr, over and out.